we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
What we do not do is spy unlawfully on Americans.
We are leaving in 2014, period. Ladies and gentlemen, we got him.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
You are listening to Biting the Bullet with Luke and Typo.
Yeah. Okay, let me do that now.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay, yep, there we go.
Cool. You're still doing like the slurp game. Oh my god.
Yeah.
Slurp game, yep. Pod stuff, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
How's that been going?
Oh, that's been going pretty well. Yeah, that's been going well as you can imagine that going.
Yeah. I catch a couple episodes every once in a while.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
They're always funny.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you.
Yeah, I watched it happen live at Childeberg. I was like, oh Jesus.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool though.
Yeah.
Doing a podcast is weird, right? When you find it like in charge of a podcast.
Right. You're like, oh wow, this is terrible. No, but
exactly.
No, it's a good time. Yeah.
That's basically what we've done for the last 2 years. It's like, oh man, another shit episode. Let's put it out there.
Right.
But today we're gonna talk of Anarchy 101. Like
that should be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been hitting fucking anti-war stuff a lot lately. What else have we been hitting? Fantasy football a lot lately, because that's Typo and I's thing.
Yeah.
And then, but the thing that we always talk about is how we don't fucking read, and that I don't really care about
that's
what
good.
All these old dead people say.
Right.
But we think we have the basic gist of anarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, don't touch people and don't take their stuff.
Yeah, that. Yeah.
We've always talked about the principle. Where do you follow the principle all the way to its logical conclusion? And, we were kind of talking about this before the show, but it's one of those things that's always been a theme of the show. So I'm really glad to have you on here to into the new age of anarchy and in Capistan, so we can get out of it in our minds and live it in the real world.
Sure.
So where do we start with Anarchy 101? Where's the birthplace where's your favorite place to start?
What is anarchy?
So there's a bunch of different ways to like explain anarchy. Like I think there's and I can just name a few of them real quick, but one of my favorites is anarchism is the philosophy that says other people are not your property, right?
Yeah.
So anarchism is the basis of anarchism completely is that each person, ethically speaking, should be regarded as a moral sovereign, which means that no one else has a right to encroach upon the boundaries of another person without their consent, right? Well, that's the whole thing with like encroaching. So like if your body is your own sovereign safeguard, or it's your own like moral like being, then, and also the property which you which is essentially resources you incorporate into your projects of your being, when you encroach upon that is seen as an aggression. And the reason that anarchists or libertarians are anarchists is because we view that as unethical or immoral. We think it is wrong to encroach upon the boundaries of another person. So essentially, anarchism idealized in its full potential would be that each person would be their own sovereign.
Okay, perfect. That's a great summary. I have a quick question about that. Is it a requirement in anarchy, just because it's come up a lot recently, is it a requirement in anarchy to derive those rights from something or someone, as in religion, God, or anything else? Or is it the natural state of being? What's like the derivative of this?
Right. So this is always gets tricky, right? This is right. There are multiple formulations as to like how you derive these rights. There's the natural law, which says that just by the nature of our being, we can deduce these norms through our own nature, that man is a rational animal, or at least has a propensity to be rational. and this confers certain things. Now, there's also objections to that, which I think are quite good. But then you also have like things like argumentation ethics, which Hans Hoppe promotes, which is the belief that within the whenever two people are entering into an argument or a debate, there are certain grund norms that are presupposed within the setting of the debate that each person implicitly abides by and agrees to by the debate. So it's kind of like a logical filter that leads you to certain anarchist principles like that. So I would say you don't need, I don't personally believe you need necessarily God or anything else like that to be an anarchist, but I certainly think that there's nothing wrong with deriving those principles from that.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Is degeneracy bad in anarchy?
Well, this is, whenever I ask people what they mean by degeneracy, they always kind of like tiptoe around it. So I'm going to say,
are Typo and I right. anarchy? Because
right. It's like, well, yeah, I don't personally buy into that. And if they mean degeneracy by just people being, you know, I guess what they would consider hedonism. No, I don't think that's necessarily counter to anarchist principles, right? You might have a debate, well, how long will a hedonistic society last versus more of like a conservative society? You know, that's up for debate, but on the principle of the matter, I don't think there's anything inherently contradictory with it.
There's hope for us, Typo.
We will survive.
I think, Typo, go ahead. I've asked like three rocket fire questions back to back, so.
Well, I'm just gonna, my thing is like I listed them a bunch out, but I just have like ones that are like the starter basic one. I stole them from his Twitter. So like, these are like basic status things. So Ace, without the government or say even the federal government, who's going to protect us from like foreign invaders like China?
Sure. I think that that's actually probably one of the best ones out of like all the starter questions, because it's the one most people can't wrap their head around the most. And I think it's a really good question. But I think when you're asking like how are we going to defend ourselves, it's all so a lot of times when people create these scenarios, right, they'll say, well, okay, in your anarchist society, what if a huge nation just comes over and tries to take you over? Well, there's always a chance, and there's, you know, depending on the hypothetical they propose, there's probably a good chance in that hypothetical that the anarchist society would lose. So you always have to be careful when you're comparing societies. But to the main question, like if China tried to invade mainland United States, it would be an absolute shit show for them. Right. It would go horribly, because there's especially in America, you have an armed populace for one. And the idea that all these Chinese troops would be able to actually invade the mainland of the United States. There's so many technical problems with it that I think that it's just kind of it's a fear mongering like point, in my opinion. And I think, and as to who would protect us, the answer is going to seem kind of like tongue in cheek, but it's like whoever will protect us, or whoever wants to protect us, or whoever has an incentive to. And that's a big one, right? Because like in anarchism, it's not like everyone just lays down and lets themselves be brutally raped, murdered, and stolen from.
Yeah, it's not this laissez-faire, like,
right.
Oh, live and let live.
Right.
It's, get over it. It's like,
it's no, not pacifism.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people equate the two, mostly because of the principle of, like, you know, being anti-war. They automatically equate that to being a pacifist.
And that's
like,
right.
No, it's not the same. What we're trying to do is don't aggress on other people. And I guess, on the certain situation, and everybody tries to bring up those hypotheticals that you just talked about, where it's very skewed towards one way. And it's like, in anarchism, what we're talking about is everything needs to go on an individual basis, one by one. You can't blanket statement things. And I think we've gotten so used to blanket statement. Statementing things. I don't even think that's a word, but doing that, we can't function, or a lot of people don't function outside that narrative, that it's like a self-fulfilling narrative at that point.
Oh, absolutely. But, yeah. It's like they're stuck in like a central, if I was the central controller, how would I organize things? Right. Well, because a lot of people feel unfulfilled by anarchist answers sometimes, because it is just like, at a certain point you do have to say, I don't know, but I trust these incentives are lined up properly enough that an answer will come. Right. And because it's like, if you asked me, you know, if you ask someone, you know, so if we were in a world where the government had a complete monopoly on production of clothes, and then someone advocated that, no, we need to let competitors come in and make clothes, people would ask, well, how would that ever happen? Or how would that even work? It's like, at a certain point, I can't tell you all the technical details, but I can show you why it would work on principle.
Well, and it goes back to that saying where, you know, that everything that's, again, every thing that's thrown at anarchism isn't already, or is already happening now.
Yeah.
And vice versa, everything that you can throw at it, that they're like, well, it doesn't solve for this. And it's like the natural order of things right now doesn't solve for that either. Yeah.
There are good arguments against anarchism, but the problem is that they're not unique to anarchism whatsoever.
Exactly.
Right. There just are good arguments against anything in that could happen in life. Right. So all things being equal, which, mind you, all things are almost never equal, but all things being equal, and if we assume power is static, a larger force will probably, you know, most cases, take over a weaker force, right? But that's true of states now. A larger state could come over and take over a smaller state. But so if their analogy, if they're saying that we need a government because a larger force could come in and take over an anarchist society, well, then the logical conclusion to that argument would be that we need a world government because large governments can take over smaller governments. But you almost never see anyone follow that to that logical conclusion. So I think that, yeah, it's not that they're wrong that this is a possibility, but they're wrong for assuming that it's a drop-dead argument against anarchism.
Yeah, that it's very unique to anarchism because it's not. All right, so let's go historically speaking, because everybody wants to bring that up. Where do we see anarchism either in the world currently or let's go prior and then we can go to world currently.
Sure. Okay. So prior first and then world currently?
Yeah, that
okay,
works.
Sure. Yeah. So two things we to differentiate. There's a difference between anarchism and then an anarchist society, right? Mm-hmm. So we could say that anarchism is the state of an experience of not being ruled by another person or another entity, right? So you could say there's lots of little pockets of momentary anarchism all over the place throughout history and right now. But historically, speaking for is if we're talking about like an anarchist society, which most people talk of, when most people say anarchism, they mean anarchist society.
Correct.
I think one of my favorite examples is probably ancient Ireland. It was a time of
love ancient Ireland. I've heard you talk about it once, and I think I've heard a couple other people talk about it. And I went and found somebody was talking about it, and they had like a YouTube channel that was specific to it. And I just went and listened to like 3 hours of dudes speaking about ancient Ireland and how, yes, there was kings and things like that, but it wasn't in the sense that we know it today. So go ahead and speak on ancient Ireland.
Yeah. So ancient Ireland what's notable about it, because it's not like it's the only anarchist society, there have been many, but what's notable about it is that it lasted close to 2000 years. We have good evidence that it lasted 2000 years. And in fact, we have not as strong evidence, but there's a possibility through some like historical records that it might have lasted even longer, closer to 9,000. Although I'm not willing to like put my name on that, but it's certainly something to consider. And I think it's plausible. What was special about ancient Ireland is that it worked off of what's known as a polycentric legal system, a legal order, which and legal order is not like conflicting with anarchy. I think that's a misconception a lot of people have. So a legal order in its most base sense is just a system to resolve disputes between parties, right? That's really all it is. And it's been bastardized by the state to mean something else, but that's what it is at its core. Ancient Ireland used a system called Brehon Law. And what this was so there were these little like, it's hard to describe because they're not feudal. They're not quite feudal in the sense that most people think they're feudal, but there were these little houses called tuas. And you could associate with any number of these, right? And they had their own internal rules and stuff like that. And essentially, whenever two people had a dispute or two competing houses had a dispute, they could pick a Brehon, which is essentially just a judge, right? But they could pick one from any number of them, right, to resolve the dispute. So it wasn't like our current legal system where the judge is essentially picked for you or you had choice in which arbiter you went to resolve your dispute in the first place. And that's kind of what made it unique. And another thing is that because it's what polycentric means is that, so as opposed to something that's a monocentric legal system coming from one source and then spreading down, polycentric is multiple overlapping like jurisdictions, right? So it wasn't like there was no monopoly. If the state is defined as a monopoly on legal violence and arbitration over a geographic area, and this polycentric legal system was not a state because there was no monopoly over a specific geography when it came to legal disputes. So when two parties had a dispute, they could go to a brehon. The brehon would try to resolve the dispute to the best of their ability. And mind you, they had an incentive to resolve it to the best of their ability between the two parties to make the two parties as happy as possible. Because if they didn't, if they were skewed one way or the other or were bribed or something, no one would voluntarily see them. So that's what's notable about that. I do want to, because I know I can predict what most people will think if they think about the court system like this. So it's like, well, you know, what happens if someone just says they don't agree to the court's decision, right? Or the brehon's decision. Well, what would happen usually in ancient Ireland would be, if someone was just uncooperative altogether, they just did not agree. What would happen is that person would be essentially labeled as an outlaw, which means that they would have no legal protection. So it's not necessarily that institutionally their rights would be violated. It's just that say, hey, if you're not going to cooperate with us, we're not going to cooperate with you or protect you. And the Tuatha Dé, which they would be associated with, which would often give them protection usually, would say, okay, we're disassociating from this person. He's no longer under our protection. And until he can, you know, make good on his debt, he's on his own, right? And that's sort of how it worked. So that's kind of a very rough summation of how ancient Ireland's like system worked.
They didn't throw him in a little steel box. They just said, hey, you got to figure it out.
They had no police or prisons. Yeah.
Right. That's fucking super interesting. All right, yeah. So what are some ways that we see it today? Anarchism, not in so much the small pocket sense, but on a larger scale. And I think you know where I'm going with that.
Yeah. Sure. So there are some anarchist societies now, or like Chiron in Mexico is a current anarchist society. Another one is Zomia, which is a location or a people, more specifically, in Southeast Asia. And I think a lot of people would think it would be unfair if I considered the whole thing a society, because what it is it's disparate groups of people with probably many societies, but it's essentially, it's a stateless area that has close to 200 million in population.
Wow.
Completely stateless right now, that exists right now. And you know, this is something that I think a lot of people don't consider, but when going back to like the definition of anarchism, where anarchism is this idea of sovereigns interacting with each other, like on a voluntary basis, a way we see this mimicked is actually states themselves. Obviously, if the citizens are there and they do get the raw end of the deal, but when they interact, they are doing so on a voluntary basis. And the whole idea of international law is actually quite polycentric. It is not necessarily, there's no world government over these governments telling them how they must interact. There's no world government saying that, you know, America and Canada must do this or we're going to wage war against them. You know, and there is war, but and I'll get to that in a second why that is. And then I think what people would come back at me and say is that, well, what about the UN? Isn't that kind of like a world government? Well, from our perspective as citizens, yes, that is. That kind of looks like one, doesn't it? But if we're sticking to the perspective of heads of state, it resembles closer to a voluntary union, right? So it's like it's a voluntary union of people.
Yeah, as citizens had an actual choice to be
right
to vote on it or whatever, and it was like a unanimous vote, let's join, then it would make more sense for it to be of that voluntary union.
That's right.
And the only reason why it doesn't resemble what we're talking about is because it's basically the heads of our state voluntarily interacting in the system.
That's right. So from the perspective of the heads of state, it does resemble a voluntary union, right? And if you just imagine how states relate to each other, the heads of state relate to each other, it does appropriate anarchism in a sense. It's not anarchism, but it appropriates it in all the meaningful ways. And it shows that the system actually is possible because the components of the system are actually, they're working right now as we speak, because like if an the whole thing, another thing people will say about like, well, if you had a polycentric legal system, you know, wouldn't that get confusing? Wouldn't the courts start fighting each other? The defense agencies start fighting each other? But it's like, if an American kills a Canadian in Mexico, they never go to war over that, right? They would almost never just go to war because that happened. There's a way they resolve these disputes. Sorry for going on this so long, but I do want to say, when the next criticism, someone say, well, what if they just went to war, right? If they just went to, you know, because we see states go to war all the time. Why? And they'll say, well, isn't that an argument against anarchism? It's like, no, what allows states to go to wage war like that is actually because of their non-anarchistic components, right? So the idea that they can forcefully tax their population to afford all of this military spending, that is the reason why they're able to wage war in the way they do and why they have an incentive to in some circumstances. So it's not because they don't have a world government over them.
Yeah, because if we know anything about war, it creates massive debts that people never pay off.
Yes.
So if that wasn't available,
right,
and for them to go into these massive debts, there wouldn't be a whole lot of war going on because there would be no way to pay the people to go to war.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot. Typo?
Who will build the roads?
The same people who build the parking lots.
Okay.
But, I can go into that one, or you can go on to the next one. It doesn't matter.
You know what? Go into it. Fuck it.
Okay, sure. Well, I always think, right, like the question of who will build the roads, well, I don't know who will build the roads. All I can tell you is that people will have an incentive to build the roads because no one wants to like walk everywhere. You know what I mean? Like,
and it's like there's already people that build the roads.
Right.
Like, there's already motherfuckers that build the roads just because they're under a government. They're usually a private company under
a government contract.
So
that's right.
It's not
yeah.
like we lose the ability to build roads.
Right. Yeah. That's the thing. Right. It's like the ability to build roads it's always been done like by private contractors. It's never been done by government agents themselves in the first place. Right. So yeah, we do not. It's not like we lose our memory of how to build the roads without the government monopolizing roads. Right. So. So yeah, I think that's probably, you know, the best thing to it. I think people might come up with a rebuttal where it's like, well, you know, how do you know like where to build the road and all this? But that's how markets work. And I can't get into it right now too much, but it's like markets work by sending signals to various people through the prices that allow them to kind of maneuver their way in the market and decide what venture is profitable, right? And that's so that will make the roads even better than they are now because there's no like price system to say, oh yeah, that road over there you just built was really inefficient. There's no signal to tell the people who build them that, so.
Right. Mm-hmm. I guess that, yeah, that makes sense. It's all, yeah, when you start getting into the exacts, it gets a little bit more difficult very lengthy.
Yes, I don't want to go on a huge rant about
on supply and demand.
Right.
Yeah, the hardest thing about that, and like, I actually don't really see it that much anymore. I mean, I'm still do, but it's not like as frequent. But the hardest thing about that is because like you have to explain that to people that really don't understand economics.
Yeah.
So like if they don't understand economics, like they're just like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like corporations, they're not going to do that. Like,
right. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's like the whole thing with like Pizza Hut needing to drive on certain roads to get to certain places. It's like, you don't think they have some sort of need
incentive.
An incentive for them
to
create the space that allows them to travel that way.
And like, I started with a joke, but think of parking lots, right? Why do stores build parking lots? Well, it's because they obviously have an incentive to let their customers park somewhere.
Yeah.
You know?
I always bring up Cabela's and what's the other one? There's another one. I think IKEA. Out here in Phoenix, they literally have, it's like IKEA Parkway or something, and it's a road that comes off the normal road, but they built it, and it's nicer than the normal road, and it goes all the way to their little building, and then it goes into their parking lot, and it's like, they built that road. They had to get it approved by the United States government, and, you know, Arizona state law, Phoenix state law, Maricopa County, but it's like all that red tape that they had to do when they...
Yeah,
they knew how to build it or could hire the people that could build it anyway.
Yeah.
And the same thing would happen in a stateless society.
Yeah. And Sweden, 2/3 of the roads in there are privately run in Sweden right now. So that's also another real word. Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Well, what are some other misconceptions of anarchy that you see on a daily basis?
God, there's... well, probably the one that it's just chaos, right? I guess that's probably the most common
one. That's the big
one.
Just,
right. I think, and you know, I've kind of gone back and forth on this because, like, the anarchist rebuttal to that is, no, well, like, law is not inconsistent with chaos. But I think, you know, I've begun to think over time that the whole chaos objection is actually people coming to the realization that we actually do live in a chaotic world, and that the state actually, they believe this lie that the state actually gives them security, right? But the truth is that, no, the state gives you this false promise of security. But there's almost like if you really take a look at it, the world is chaotic, and you have to do your best as possible to make your way through it with as least, like, incurring the least amount of harm as possible. So it's not that anarchism is chaotic, it's that the world is chaotic, but anarchism provides a more voluntary order compared to the state's order.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I feel like that's like a very, it's, people get so frustrated with how succinct anarchy can be, like how almost simple. Like, it's pretty simple, because like you said earlier, there's not a lot that you can be like, yes, here, I know exactly this, that, or the other. It's a lot of it is, and why Typo and I at least are kind of right-leaning anarchists, but that doesn't mean that the left side of anarchism doesn't understand certain aspects.
Yeah.
They just see it more as a more collective agreement that they're all going to do something, but they're all sending the same price signals as we would imagine as right-leaning anarchists, that they're saying, hey, this is something that needs to happen, so either let's collectively pool our money together, or somebody specifically needs something specifically, and then they go out and pay for it themselves.
Yeah. And a good analogy for this is actually language itself, right? Because language is the most decentralized creation of all time, right? It's like, so like if I was saying that, you know, if I was giving an analogy, you know, about abolishing the state, and I said, look, this language we're using right now is really ineffective and, you know, whatever, and I think we need a better way to describe our experiences in the world. And then someone came up to me and said, okay, well, what are we going to call that in your new language? What are we going to call that or that or that? It's like, well, I don't know what we're going to call it, but certainly it doesn't mean that, you know, this language that we're currently using is effective, right? You know what I mean? So it's like, you kind of just do have to take this like leap of faith and just assume that, okay, we live in a world of spontaneous order all the time. So once you recognize that, you feel a lot more comfortable realizing that, this can just all work out voluntarily.
I don't know. It's always so funny that people get so worked up on like the very specific things when it's like this very specific things. It's like you were bitching about the roads yesterday because there's potholes all over them, but now you're worried about it in an anarchist society. Like, what's going to happen to the roads? And it's, I think it's that fear of taking that leap, like you said.
Yeah. And sorry, I didn't mean to go on such a long rant about roads.
No, you're fine.
Oh, you're fine. I actually learned some stuff. I was like, I actually didn't know that.
Yeah, the Sweden thing was nice.
Oh,
was
yeah.
Like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
They got private roads. See, even more reason. Like, and don't get me wrong, I get it. Like, that area up there, Norway, Sweden, it's very known for it being as socialist as can be.
Very welfare state, but
Very welfare state. Yeah. And there's so many parts about it that are actually, you know, very privatized and very individualistic, which is,
and they're not going around the world murdering children either. Yeah, so, you know, that's probably, it's a low bar, but that's, you know.
It's because they're mostly free market. They just have a really, really high tax rate.
Yeah.
So that's how they fund their shit. Yeah. It's not, and I think they still can, like, their healthcare, like, it's not like they have to use the government healthcare. They actually, the government just pays for their healthcare.
Yeah.
So like, so they get to pick where they go and where they provide. So there's still that economic incentive of like, oh, this has to be a good doctor's office, or they won't bring their government money to you, basically.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's like a voucher system. But this is always a big one that I think mainly you always hear from like lefties. I think me and Luke both know the answer to it, but I kind of want to go over it. If there's no government, then these big corporations can just take over because they're going to have all this money and they're going to have monopolies, and then we'll all be like wage slaves under these corporations.
Yeah, this is the biggest like dupe in economic history, right? This idea of that the spontaneous corporation that just takes over and just turns itself into a monopoly. You never see this at all. Like for you to see this naturally, the environment has to be constructed in such a way that it has to be like almost impossible to recreate. Like you would have to have like you would have to be on in some island or something, right? Where it was like just some absurd example, but naturally occurring monopolies are almost never exist. They're almost always due to state involvement. So an example of this, right, is that most corporations today lobby for regulations. Now people would say, well, why would they lobby for regulations? Well, because they know they can afford the best lawyers and they can either get out of these regulations or just pay the cost of the regulations themselves. And they know that will hurt their competitors. So they're using these corporations in effect become an arm of the state in advocating for aggression against the smaller competitors. And the less competitors in the market means that there's going to be less people, there's going to be less competition in vying for labor, which means that the cost of labor is going to go down because there's more workers, less places to work. So cost of labor goes down because so many people are trying to be the worker and not everyone is going to be. So if you lived in a place where there was no government to be able to do that or to lobby against that, for corporations to lobby against their competitors, you would see a lot more competitors spring up. And in a sense, they would absorb more of the market share and they would take away the market share from those corporations, which means that these corporations are making less money over time because obviously they're not the only big dogs in town. And the rate of wages would become much more natural as there's more competitors trying to get workers rather than workers trying to get a job as it is now. And that's why wages tend to have stagnated so much in modern day America.
Hmm. That was a better explanation on the last part of why wages are stagnant than anything that I could come up with.
So thank you
for that.
Absolutely.
I'm going to use that. I'm going to go back and listen to that and memorize exactly what you just said so I can say it to everybody else.
Okay.
One of the things that I think ties into that specifically is, why are IP laws bullshit?
Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's perfect. Yeah,
my dad needs this one. He's still stuck on this one.
Okay. Yeah, so,
and the big one that so I'll just start this out real quick. The big one that I end up having a hard time arguing, even though I feel like I know the right answer, I just am not good enough like
communicating it.
Yeah. Right now, I can't even fucking explain what it is. Is like with one of the big ones that I always get and I get stuck on is like music, art, things like that.
Yeah.
So we'll do the corporation side, and then it's going to lead into the same thing.
Because it'll all go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think for this one, this is like a lot of libertarians also don't see like why IP law is illegitimate. So I think the best way to explain it, right, is we have to talk about theft, because this is what IP law is about, right? So there's a lot of ways people talk about theft, right? So there's a colloquial term of theft, which is that I'm being ripped off, or that comedian over there stole my joke, right? And, you know, colloquially, these are fine, right? It's just like, that's how people did slang. That's how people use the term. But the libertarian view of theft is very specific in what it means. The libertarian view of theft is that I have been deprived something, right? Something, I had something and now I don't have it. That's what it means to have stolen something in a libertarian sense. You reduced the amount, you reduced what this person had. So when it comes to IP law, intellectual property, if I write down, if I write a book, let's say, right, and then someone copies my book, I have not lost the book. Someone has just created a duplicate of it. Now, the next thing someone will say, right, was that, well, you have stolen the potential profits that someone could have made had you not copied the book. But see, this gets into a huge dilemma here, because under libertarian theory, you do not own potential profits, right? And an example I can use to like hit that home is that if you did own potential profits, then market competition itself would be illegitimate. Because if I owned a store and another store opened up next to me and was selling like a very similar product to me, but they were selling it was better in some way, and I lost all my customers, it wouldn't be fair to say that they stole my customers, right? Or now I have been deprived of potential profits because this person took what I was doing and made it better. So this is the reason why IP is essentially illegitimate, is because copying is not theft. If I copy something, and now that's not to say, I have to be clear here, that doesn't mean that you're not like a dick if you just rip off someone's work and right. then just, you know, but it's just on a purely like libertarian legal basis. It's not theft because you have not deprived the person of something. They have not lost anything. If someone tells me an idea, so you own the thoughts in your head, but you do not own the thoughts in my head. So if you tell me an idea, it's just the nature of language and ideas to replicate and copy in other people's heads. So if you tell me an idea and it copies in my head, you don't have a right to the idea in my head. You know what I mean? Right. So and you don't lose the idea in your head either when I, you know, enact the idea. So nothing has been lost. It's only been duplicated. So that's the crux of the issue as to why IP law is illegitimate, is because it's the state used it threatening violence against people for essentially not violating anyone else's rights because that person did not steal, they just copied.
Right. It's really funny that it seems like it is a problem in like the libertarian circles. It kind of seems like to get people riled up, but yeah. it's funny to see it on the left when they argue it. Because mm-hmm. they're the ones that want, you know, they're the ones that talk about how, what's the insulin is so hard to come by.
Oh, and yeah.
The EpiPens are so
right.
so rough and they're so expensive and it's bullshit that these people have a monopoly basically right. on yep. these things. And the reason why they have it is because of IP law.
Yes.
When all of it can be reverse engineered and created on a much yeah. cheaper scale.
A lot of people don't see IP law as a big issue in libertarian circles, and I completely disagree. I think it's a huge issue. Yeah. I think like if you're a libertarian and you're opposed to monopoly, you're opposed to like you understand like the market effects of like having a single provider for a good or a service, then you should be apoplectic about the idea of IP law, because the fact that IP law exists means that it strangles the potential of other competing and entrepreneurs to come and undercut them and, you know, make a better product, because people die every year because when the left criticizes all these expensive like drugs and pharmaceuticals, I agree that, you know, I agree with like what they're saying, but they just have a wrong conclusion about how to fix it, of course. But they're absolutely right. Like a lot of people die every year because in a natural market, all these things would be much cheaper. Naturally, because there'd be more people producing them, more competitors, which would drive the rate of profit down to a more equilibrium, like rate, it would approach zero, right? As right. market competition does. So that's why it's so important to abolish IP law, because it actually does have real world effects, and life would be a lot better for a lot more people if the state was not, you know, aggressing against people like this.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's used. Oh, go ahead, typo.
Yeah, it severely stifles innovation, and
yes.
There's a lot of like, and the main people that use IP laws are the big corporations that make all the
yes.
money, because they just monopolize the market somehow, and they're able
That's
to
right.
have all this money, and
yeah.
because they're the only people that can sell it.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, even in even like the libertarians who would argue that IP is legitimate, it's like, you know, they can't even argue it from a like a property rights perspective, where it's like, you know, through like libertarian property rights, the first user of a resource has the best claim to it. But no, that's not true in IP law. It's the first person to get to the patent office who has the best claim to it.
Right.
So even in their formulation, it's not based in any like type of grounding like actual property rights are.
Well, and like even if they tried to use that as their like whole basis, is it would create a system where you'd still have to rely on the state
yes.
to allow it to be monopolized, basically.
Right.
It's like, well, that goes against everything that you've been arguing with
about right.
property rights in the general sense. Like
it
goes
exactly.
against you owning your house. It
right.
goes against you owning your car. It
and
goes
I,
against all of that.
I also want to say, because I sorry to be on this so long.
No, you're fine. I love this topic
okay.
because it's very it seems nuanced, but in my head, it's not nuanced at all. And a lot of people act like it's nuanced. So I
yeah.
think it's a big part of anarchism and why it should be.
Yeah.
You know,
so, I think one of the reasons, because like here's the like biggest thing like people will say in defense of IP, they'll say, well, I, you know, labored for this thing mentally, I put my work into it, so why don't I own it? I put my work into this idea, so why don't I own it? And this is very important, because the reason why libertarians in general, we support property rights, is because property or resources, external resources, are scarce. And by scarce, I don't mean that they're low in quantity. I mean that they, if I'm using something, you can't also be using it in the same way at the same time, right? Right. They're rivalrous is a better term. So because of this, this means that because two people can't be using the same thing at the same time, we need to award a claim, a better claim, to one person or the other. And the only just one from the libertarian perspective, and I think the correct answer, is the first person who did this. Now, why is it the first user? Because the first user was the only one who acquired it without violating another person's, by encroaching on another person to get it, right? So like it goes back to like, so you start from property rights by saying that no one has a right to encroach on me or my boundaries. And then you get to, okay, I have acquired these resources now. And the first person to acquire these resources did so without encroaching on anyone else by definition, right? It's like a tautology. It must be true by the nature of the statement itself. So, but that's not true of a second user necessarily. If a second user comes in, they have now taken from the first user, whereas the first user did not take from that any user. And because things are scarce and they're rivalrous, that's why we assign property rights to things. Ideas are not scarce, as we were just saying, right? If I say an idea, it can duplicate in your head and you can tell it to someone else and can duplicate. So it can be infinitely duplicated.
Yeah, it's replicated constantly forever and ever. Like that's nobody can stop it from replicating.
And therefore, because of that, it's not an actual issue of property rights at all. And that's why IP is bullshit.
To finish it off.
Yeah.
IP is bullshit. Yeah. I always think it's so crazy because it's, I like using music because a lot of the times it's usually musicians that start talking about it and things like that. And that's where you had the big companies like Napster when it came out and, you know, LimeWire, which I'm sure we all used and all that fun stuff, where they would get super pissed and they're like, we're not being paid for our things. And then you had like cover bands and stuff like that. They always get, they either have to pay royalties or sometimes they get away with it if they're small enough, you know. But it's one of those things where it's a type one. I really like the song Hurt by Nine Inch Nails is the original, right?
Yeah, the original is Nine Inch Nails.
Nine Inch Nails, but fucking Johnny Cash did it way better.
Right, yeah.
So, and it's like, you pay for, if I wanted to pay for it, and if you could create a way, and I'm sure that there would be some way that people would be like, hey, you know, this song you can only buy on this CD, and then there's something on the CD that makes it so you can't replicate it onto your hard drive, so you can't give it to other people.
That exists now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there's things like that are already in place, but Johnny Cash did it better, and it's almost a completely different song if you really look at it. But if he hadn't asked for, you know, to be able to use it, then Nine Inch Nails wouldn't have been it, or he wouldn't have ever been able to make any money off of it, and that's this, that, or the other, even though people would pay for what they wanted. You know, if they wanted the Nine Inch Nails version, they would go for that. If they wanted the Johnny Cash version, they would go for that. Me being the musical guru that I think that I am, I like both. And sometimes I think Nine Inch Nails is better on some days, but I guess it just depends on what mood I'm in.
Right. that makes sense.
Yeah. Fuck. There's a. I think IP is so integral to the state of anarchy.
Like
what anarchism is. And so one thing that I've always. We brought it up at the beginning and we talked about it before is. On the principle side of things, the way things are going right now, is it beneficial to take the anarchist principled stance on everything, or to get to an anarchist society in the way that our society is shaped now, we might have to sacrifice principles to go and continue on? What do you think about
that? Well, this is the question anarchists have been debating for centuries. So I think it would depend on what you mean by beneficial. I assume you mean like pragmatically, like efficient, or like to get from point A to point B.
Right.
So I think I would answer, I don't know.
The anarchist answer.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. So like, I think one of the problems, like, people get mad at libertarianism for like not having a strategy, or there's not like a real strategy to get to there. But I think people kind of, I feel like that criticism is kind of wrong, or it's not wrong, but it's like, it's levied. It's like getting mad that the square block isn't fitting inside the triangle. Like, libertarianism isn't meant to be a strategy. It's just meant to be an ethical system where you can just like determine which actions are justified and which are not. But to your main point, I think that, you know, there might be that you could certainly probably get to some situation where it's like, okay, if we just stick by our principles, there might be a worse outcome later on. Whereas if we just violate a little bit of our principles now, we might get to an anarchist society sooner. I kind of take the position where it's like, okay, you can do that. I mean, you know, you can do that in a descriptive sense, but it's like, if you're violating people's rights to get there, I'm still going to side with the people's rights who you're violating. And I'm still going to say they still have a right to resist their rights being violated, no matter what. Right. So even if you do want to use a pragmatic option to get to somewhere, I think it's always important to remember that the people who are being aggressed against still always have a right to resist that. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that, yeah, that makes sense to me. And that's kind of where I'm at. It's like,
if I was like, because this example actually comes up a lot, where it's like, if I'm starving to death or I'm dying of thirst and there's a bottle of water, can I steal the bottle of water from this guy's home to drink? It's like, I would probably steal it. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then, but I would still recognize that I have stolen and I would owe him restitution all the same.
Right.
So, you know, those kind of situations, I can't speak to what someone should do in all those circumstances. I can only say that it would still be a rights violation to do it, and you should make good on it if you do. That's yeah.
Yeah. That's the principle.
Yeah, I've heard people before say like I don't know, especially people with kids when they have whatever, if someone if you know their kids are hungry, they're like, I'm going to rob someone. I don't care. Sure. I'm going to do whatever I can to protect my kids. And it's like, okay, I understand that you're willing to violate the principles or mm-hmm. our principles and that certain situation. It just doesn't mean that you're not violating
yes,
principles.
That's right.
Like you're still
yeah
aggressing and possibly hurting someone to that, you know, maybe in your mind, in your situation is the greater good. And I think a lot of people would understand that situation.
Yeah, totally.
But at the same time, it's still violating principles in the end. And
that's right. Yeah. I'm if someone's honest about it, I'm perfectly fine. I kind of get a little peeved when people try to like say it's not, or try to do some mental gymnastics to say, no, well, actually this is the principled position. It's like, well, I don't really think so. But yeah, if someone's honest about it and they're like, yeah, I would do anything to protect my kids, I get it. Right. You know, I totally get that. But it's also like, I do think you should just at least realize that, yeah, if you violate someone's rights, they do have a right to resist you. Right. And that, even if you don't think that would be right in the moment, if they did, or maybe they would be a dick to resist you. I would probably agree with that. You know, if you're like stealing a loaf of bread to feed your kids or something, but I would still say that it's still a rights violation and you do still owe them restitution for it.
Right. And well, yeah, that, I think a lot of people get the misconception where if you, or they use it, it's a misconception to say, or they kind of like gaslight you and they're like, well, your principled, view on this, means that it's okay. And it's like, I don't think that it's okay. I would probably be like, no, that other person, like the whole bottle of water one, mm-hmm. if I was that person with the bottle of water that it was stolen from me, I'd probably be like, oh yeah, no, he needed the bottle of water more than I did. I probably wouldn't come looking for restitution. But if somebody did, yes, I think it would be, they should be able to. And I'd also probably be like, that dude's a fucking dick. I never want to fucking talk to that dude ever.
That's right. Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to trade with him. So fuck that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
And it goes back to, you know, the basis of what this, like what anarchism is. In my opinion, how I came into anarchism was the very economic position of like, mm-hmm. all right, supply and demand, market signals, things like that. Like, I think those were very, they were the essence of what it came from mm-hmm. For me. And then learning the more ideology side of it came a little bit after. But just from the basic principles of, you know, supply and demand and markets and how you should interact with other people, and the way you interact with other people determines the amount of wealth that you can get too in a society that wouldn't have these market pricing that gets centralized or centrally planned, then it would change a lot of the outcomes that people would make up in their heads.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to say it would not be unlibertarian or against anarchist principles if a court just threw that case, if he did try to like go for restitution for you stealing the water bottle, the court would be fully within its rights to say, no, we're not going to charge him, go pound sand, right? And we're just not going to, you know, it would be fully within their rights to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it always goes back to that saying where all the nail in the dagger or the heart, the nail in the heart anarchism, you can lay out the same descriptions in today's day and age and those things aren't solved for. And it's just asinine to people just write off this whole thing mostly to chaos. That's what they equate the two. Yeah. And it's just not it.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. There's always like, I mean, I think Michael Malice did this the best, at least for me, there's a shit ton of things that our government does. So there's a shit ton of things our government does that has been doing longer than I've been alive. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for people like me to imagine like, oh, what would we do without the fucking health department? Right. Like, oh, what are we going to do if some crazy pandemic comes, like actual virus that kills people comes and fucking comes to the nation? Like, what the fuck do we do? And I think Michael Malice is always good as like, well, look what the state does now, or this is happening right now and the state's here and they're not stopping this.
Yeah. If we didn't have cops, you know, people could march in the streets and burn down our cities. It's like,
this one's always, it's big in the news, and it's really big for like right wingers, at least right now. Like, how would anarchist society defend its borders, or you know, people that maybe they're, you know, coming from different cultures, they're steal my jobs and fucking whatever. Like, who's gonna stop a bunch of people just coming in here willy-nilly?
Yeah, this is great because I've wanted to clarify my position on this for a long time, because I think a lot of people have a misunderstanding. So from my position, and this is still debated, right? This isn't like an open and shut case. It's still debated among libertarians, but I'm going to give my view of it here. So someone merely crossing the state's border, I've never heard a good case as to why that's a rights violation from a libertarian perspective, right? Merely just crossing the border. So most people will say that, well, when they cross the border, they're going to come here and they're going to vote, and they're going to take subsidies, and I'm against that, right? So as a libertarian, I don't think they have a right to the subsidies, and I don't agree with voting at all, or in most cases. So yeah, I'm opposed to that, but I think a lot of libertarians tend to like bundle up these things together and make you choose, okay, yes or no, between all these, you know, when one action's a right violation and one they have a right to do. So when they bundle it up, it kind of creates a false dichotomy here. So I think it's important to say that a person who crosses the border is not violating your rights. And by border, I mean state border. I don't mean private border, right? A private property border. I'm talking about just the state's border itself. When they cross that border, they are not violating your rights. And you have some libertarian or some right wingers who will say that, yeah, well, they're going to go on welfare, but it's like, okay, this is the same argument the left uses for wanting to ban guns, right? They'll say that, well, if we allow them to buy guns, they could go out and murder people with them. But just because someone could go out and take that gun and murder someone, that does not mean they don't have a right to buy the gun in the first place. So in the same way, the immigrant has a right to come over the border, but that doesn't justify what they do after they come over the border. You know what I mean? They're two separate issues there. They're not intertwined. Even if it may look like that in retrospect.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people would tell you that you're living in Ancapistan in your head.
Right.
And that's not how the world works. And it's like, bro, and that's the thing, right? It's where do you delineate? And I think you did it perfectly. They're two separate issues.
Yeah.
Them crossing the border isn't a violation of anything. Them crossing the border and getting government subsidies,
that's right.
It's an issue. That's definitely an issue that you can be worried about. And But the issue there isn't them crossing the border.
That's right.
The issue there is the government giving them subsidies.
That's right,
or
yeah.
The government allowing them on welfare, or the government, right. You know, that's the issue. And I don't think it's separated like that very often.
Yeah, exactly. So like, and again, this is like the, you know, as I was saying, this is like the left's view of guns, where it's like, well, we can't allow people to buy guns because they could go out and murder people with them. So like with libertarianism, we have to always distinguish between what step is a rights violation, and at what point does it become a rights violation? It's like, okay, is it here, or is it here? It's like, okay, buying the gun was not the rights violation. Shooting someone with it is the rights violation. So if we want to be consistent about it, and again, there's pragmatic arguments you could make against immigration, which I think are fine, but that's not what I'm arguing here. But it's just the principle of the thing where it's like, okay, him stepping over the border is not where does it become the rights violation? At what point in this process that you laid out? So I think it's very important to distinguish that. And one more thing on that topic is I used this analogy the other day, actually, which is like, you know, and this might make some people mad, which is people will say, because people will think this is a very reasonable thing from a libertarian perspective. I was like, well, I support open borders, but only after welfare is done away with, right? But then you kind of have to, I thought of this analogy the other day where it's like, okay, let's imagine that the state was subsidizing parents having children, right? And every time someone had a kid, they would get more subsidy money from the government. Would the libertarians be comfortable with the position that said we feel comfortable forcing people to not have any children until we're done with subsidies? You know what I mean? So I think that would obviously be, you know, that would, people would say, well, no, of course not. Well, it's like, okay, well then, I think that's a direct allegory to the immigration debate. So, but you know, there's, I can understand like the pragmatic argument against immigration. So I get that, but I just wanted to lay out the principled argument.
Yeah.
And typo to your point about like the right wing thing was like, you know, well, what about my job? It's like, I think you should, the direct libertarian response would be like, you know, you don't have a right to the job necessarily. But with that being said, I want to say that because of how the state works right now, the way is what I was going to before about how the wages are artificially low because the state restricts the amount of competitive businesses that can open up and fight to make you a worker, essentially. So that the state, ultimately, well, my point is the state is your real enemy here, and not the immigrant, and not anything else.
Yeah, not the gun, not the immigrant.
That's
not,
right.
Not the
not the child. Yeah.
Yeah, not the child. Well, sometimes children are enemies too.
Yes, so. That's true. That's true. Yeah.
Fuck them kids.
Yeah.
So we're all right. What are some things that we've missed? I'm trying to go over them in my head. For Anarchy 101. Is there anything that's glaringly obvious that we've missed on Anarchy 101 there, Ace? Typo, you got anything glaringly obvious that you wanted to ask?
Well, I don't know. This one's always been like an I don't know, and I haven't really thought of another theory, but, and I don't really know a historical reference for it. But a one that seems to string a couple people on is, what if a child with abusive parents?
Oh, okay.
If the state doesn't have the authority, because they have the monopoly on violence, to go in and forcibly remove the child from abusive mm-hmm. parents, what is going, or who, or what, or how would that process be handled without a state?
So this is always a very tricky issue because it's almost, at some point it's almost subjective, right? We know there's a line to abuse, but we're bad at like placing, okay, when does it become abuse and when does it not?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's difficult.
I think everyone can agree there is a line somewhere. So if we just take that, okay, abuse is a real thing and it can happen, if we move from there, I do think that people would have a right to come in and rescue the child. Right. I don't think children, this is very important. I don't think children are property of their parents. I think children have rights. They're just, the rights are in, you can think of their rights are in an escrow where they have them, but they're not available to them because of their limited like cognitive ability and function. So they still have their rights, but they can't access all of them in the same way that like, I won't make that analogy now, but because that'll just be more confusing. But anyway, my point is, I do think you can go in, and I do think you can, if the child is being abused, we just assume for a second, which I know it's assuming a lot, we just assume the child is actually being abused, then yes, I do actually think anyone could rightfully go in and rescue the child.
Yeah. It's like if you watched a parent blatantly punch their child in the face as hard as they could, let's assume that's the abuse that was witnessed. It'd be the same to me as watching a man hit another man.
It would be worse.
It'd be worse. Yeah. But on the principle side of it, it would be the same to me as me going and stopping that guy.
That's right.
Regardless of what the scenario was, like, let's just say the dude came out of Walmart. There was a dude that was just outside. They definitely didn't meet or anything else before. Mm-hmm. And he just swacks a dude in the face. And I go and stop and probably swack the dude that just swacked the other dude. Like, right. That would be... I think that would kind of go into the same thing where if it happened to a child, and that's the, if we're not arguing what abuse is and that there, this was the line of the abuse that we saw, I think that's a viable option to be able to be like, yo, and you're not allowed to have this fucking kid anymore. Cause what the fuck was
that? And I think one of the problems people have a hard time with this right now is because they have a very good case, right? Which is that the state's child protective services are terrible. It's almost
worse than leaving them with the abusive abusive family.
Yes, like if you look at the statistics on how many children are abused in government facilities and stuff like that, it's insane. The numbers are absolutely insane. And if more people paid attention to them, they'd be asking for those people's heads. You know what I mean? So I understand why people are scared of dipping their toe into the topic of taking children from their parents, because obviously we don't want the state to have them. But if there actually is an abusive parent, you absolutely have a right to get that child away from their abusive parent.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it changes very much in that sense.
Yeah.
I think your explanation where they have rights, they're just kind of on escrow, is a good one, because I always kind of wondered that too, where it's like, at what point can they, say fuck off to their parents and go off and do their own thing? And I think that's different for everybody. I think that's the basic case for anarchy, is everybody's their own sovereign. And like you said at the beginning, and when there was a certain point where I probably could have gone off on my own. Yeah. And
More determined by the culture society you live in. Like, some cultures might be like, hey, you're 12, dude, get the fuck out of the house. Yeah. And in America, that's insane to us. So I think a lot of these things depend on the culture that's surrounding the
child. And you have to think of so if you're drunk or something and you're very much inebriated, it would be someone may have you sign a contract while you were really drunk. That contract would not be legitimate, right? And that's kind of what I used to analogize a child. A child is a very inebriated adult who can't really function well. So it's so at a certain point, that's why children, they have rights, but they can't really, it's depending on the contract, you can't really bind them to contracts, and they can't really express their rights in the way that they would normally be able to with a normal cognitive capacity.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a good one. I didn't think about that one. Good question, typo.
it's always a tricky one. It's really tricky. We joked about it a lot, but we were talking about the age of consent a lot, and
it's always a big one in libertarian circles.
And I don't know, but what was acceptable here in my community and what was acceptable in Luke's community is probably completely different. Smaller towns, man, there's not that many choices, so people tend to go a little younger than they're supposed to, I don't know,
I think cultures around the world
are all different.
With the age of consent thing, I think there's a range, but I think there's a hard limit on the range. Do you know what I mean? It's 16 or 17 or 18, I think that's perfectly debatable. In there somewhere, I don't really have a problem. But once you start getting real lower, you're okay, well, wait a minute here. You know what I mean? There's a debate, but there's a range within the debate. There's a certain cutoff between what is an acceptable debate for that.
Well, and the same thing, a lot of it falls on what Typo's saying, the culture, but a lot of it falls on the parents themselves and they are willing to allow and not sell their kids escrowed rights, basically.
Right.
Making them get married at 16 when it's not somebody that, those aren't things that I think are acceptable, because you said, they are their rights. It's not the parents' rights to be able to you know, do whatever they want with them. They're absolutely not property, yeah. So they can't be sold, or negotiated with, or used as a negotiating point.
Yeah. Oh, you guys want to talk about the baby market? Oh, Rothbard's baby market.
Yeah, go ahead. Explain that real quick.
Yeah, so Rothbard got criticized in his book because he advocated a market for children, for like as a way to for them to escape abusive households. This was essentially his way of, or like set, putting children up for adoption, where people would essentially like pay money and then they'd get the kid. And I always get that people always talk about this and cite this to me, and I think it's very important to distinguish something here. They're not buying the child. They're buying the guardianship title to the child. You know what I mean? So I that's a diversion here, but I just wanted, that popped in my head, and I kind of wanted to just address that here because I've never done it before. And I just, yeah. So
I
yeah,
there's didn't know about that. So that's, yeah. That's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Well, what, like you've talked about this actually quite a few times, but I would kind of go more direct at it. Well, without like a government, how will we have any sort of objective law? Like,
I love this one.
If there's no laws, if there's no laws that like everyone like is forced to fall under, then you know, people can just do what they want.
Sure. So first, I want to plug something, which is John Hasnis, who is one of the best like anarchist theorists who ever lived. He's still alive. He wrote an essay called "The Myth of the Rule of Law." And it goes into this topic just piece by piece, and it's fantastic. So essentially, my direct answer to this would be, there's no objective law now. Like the idea of an you can claim, so, right, we have to separate something here. The NAP is fairly objective in the sense that it doesn't, you know, there's some subjective parts of the NAP and stuff like that and libertarian property rights. But once you get past that, it's pretty objective. So there are, we do have a system of moral norms we believe are like, once we can get past this, you know, some of the subjective areas are generally objective. But for like the law or the legal system, like how do we know, like if one area can come up with a law over here and another area can come up with a law over here, aren't they just going to fight it out, you know? And I mean, this actually goes back to what we were saying before about like, there are right now on Earth, there are things called countries, and they have different laws, very different laws, almost anathema to other countries, right? And sometimes you can have people from these countries go to the other countries and they can commit crimes there, and these countries don't go to war because, you know, well, that wasn't a legal standard in my country with my citizens, so why are, you know, you imposing on him, right? So there are ways, so my ultimate argument would be that it exists right now. It even exists within geographic localities within countries, right? So you have this like federalism, where it's like, California's laws. Right. California's laws and New York's laws are not the same as Florida's laws, right? So there's no objective law now. And even if you wanted to appeal, now let me steel man their argument for a second, which is that they'll say, yeah, but we have a Supreme Court. It's like, well, for one, the Supreme Court, there's nothing that says the Supreme Court can't rule on the same case they've already ruled on. And those people are more likely going to be different judges. So there is no actual everlasting law that exists in any legal system ever. Like ever. Like none. Well,
and there probably shouldn't be.
Yeah, exactly. And this was John Hasnis's point, which is that like, why is the same norm for someone, you know, across the pond the exact same as, you know, someone in a hill country or something like that? You know what I mean? It's like, it makes no sense why, like, these norms, these legal systems, these ways of adjudicating disputes is going to be different depending on the like cultural standards of that community. And you know, you could say as a libertarian, well, you know, as long as it doesn't violate the NAP, well, sure, but if we're just talking like descriptively here, it's like, that's just what's going to happen naturally. So it's like, I don't think there's a way to stop it necessarily.
Yeah. I don't think it's kind of like, I know for all the laymen out there, it's like, especially all the military guys, it's like the different customs and norms in the Marine Corps, where it's like at one unit, you know, yes, corporal, no corporal is required. And if you don't do it, you're doing push-ups or doing extra fucking duties, extra fucking. Or whatever. Extra fucking. And then on the other side of it, where that isn't the cultural norm, kind of like where we were in 9th ESB, it was just whatever. And everybody went around calling everybody by their first names.
Right.
And it's very dependent. And it's not a law. It wasn't a rule. Right. But at the same other principle. Place, it was a rule.
Right.
And like at this place, it wasn't a rule. And that's kind of how it's going. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. Like you said, it's how it is now today, different jurisdictions. And I think people would argue that makes us polycentric in our legal system.
Or at least it resembles it, at least.
And I would say exactly that it resembles it to a certain extent. But the fact that there is an overarching monopoly on it, which is the federal government, is what makes it not that. And, you know, you're going from fucking, I don't know, Phoenix, Arizona to L.A. Yeah, there's two different types of law, but the types of things that are rights-based get very finicky, and the rights-based part is where there should be it's not arbitrary almost. Like,
right.
You know, like that those things, you can't murder somebody. You can't steal from them. You can't make them lose some
part. But on people's property, there's going to be very different rules, like depending on, so that's going to be, that's how that'll manifest, right? Like some people will be fine with having drugs on their property. Some people won't be. And that's just, that's how it's going to, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's just how it'll be. Yeah.
And I'm fucked. That's how it is now.
That's how it is now. Yes, that's how it is now. And with the state, because I do want to address one thing I think people could come back with, right? It's sort of the same. It was like, yeah, but we have a constitution, right? But like this goes back to the whole thing where it's like, okay, there is no, if you give people a monopolistic right to make the law, you have no way to check those people within the law itself, because so here's the thing, right? What people say, well, no one is above the law. And that's like, it's factual, but it's not truthful, because what that is that no one is above the law, but some people are very much below it. Some people are very much below the law, and that's you and me. And the people those people are the law. So they're not above the law. The people who make the law all are the law. So when people give this whole idea, well, anarchism is just the might makes right. It's like, no, might makes right is what we have right now.
Yeah.
Like right now.
Yeah. In your debate with Brad, he was like, well, I think you brought up something similar. And he was like, well, the Constitution has a system of checks and balances. Can you go into why it doesn't have checks and balances?
Absolutely. Yes. Real this quick. This is awesome, right? This is my fun.
Just in general.
Yeah. Yeah. So people always talk about how, you know, well, we have checks and balances. It says this, and this. It says, you know, the legislature, we have the judicial, and then the executive, right? And these branches of government are supposed to check each other. But that's just ostensibly what the Constitution says. That's just what it says it's supposed to do. It actually gives no outline as to why that mechanically would work the way it says. None at all. So what incentive does the legislature have to check the president's power, really? Like what, at a certain point you have to introduce game theory into this, and you have to theorize, okay, why wouldn't all three of these branches just start working together? There's no reason for them not to work together in most situations, and that's what happens.
And it does. And if fucking the last 18 months hasn't showed you that they do, then I don't know what to fucking tell you.
Right. And that's not to say that, you know, I don't want to make the state seem monolithic in the sense that, you know, the state is made up of a bunch of different gangs and they're vying for power. But these gangs, just like how in a sense, like if you and I enter into a market transaction, we're both going to mutually benefit from it if it went through in most cases. Right. So it's the same way for power with politicians when it comes to power. They are going to mutually, they're going to agree to things that are mutually beneficial that raise both of their power. So it's they don't really have an incentive to fight each other in the same way that two competing businesses would have a way to compete against each other, because they are not reliant on keeping their promises in the Constitution. They can just do whatever they want. It's like, this is the whole thing against the Constitution, right? Which is that the very people it's supposed to limit are the people who have a monopolistic interpretation of the Constitution and enforcement of the Constitution. So there's no, giving, you want to be protected from being murdered. So you find a murderer and you give him the gun and say, hey, please protect me. Right. It'd be like, it's just insane.
Yeah. Most of their arguments are insane, and they drive me crazy that I can't put the words together as well as you do.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
To show them to everybody on Twitter how stupid that their argument is. It works out really well, and it's very entertaining.
I just I just always retweet and put like those like one GIFs of like the drawing of like the dumb person. I'm like, yeah, this person's dumb, but I really can't explain why you're dumb.
That works. That works though. Yeah, that's fine.
So that's the way it works out. Well, I think that summed up Anarchy 101. If there's not anything glaring that you can remember.
Go ahead. What were you
I was going to say anything that you wanted to come on here and explain to libertarians that you think have your idea wrong or what you have said incorrectly before that you wanted to clarify, anything like that? You're like, no, I'm fucking money all the time.
No. I can't. No, I just can't think of anything off the top of my head right now, but I probably will right as we end this. We're going to be like, damn, should have said that. No, I would probably just say, there is one thing. I think, like I said this earlier, but I kind of want to expand on it just a little bit.
Yeah.
I do think people get confused a lot of times when they're talking about anarchism. When most people talk about anarchism, what they mean is an anarchist society, right? But anarchism itself is more of just a philosophy. It's a way to distinguish which actions, and this is true of all moral philosophy, so this isn't unique to anarchism either, which is that it's to distinguish which actions between interpersonal agents are legitimate and which are not, right? So the anarchist would obviously say that any interaction that encroaches upon another person by initiating coercion on them or, you know, their property by extension is immoral or wrong or unethical, however you want to phrase it. But an anarchist society is just the culmination of those anarchist interactions, right? So every society is built upon smaller societies, micro societies, and those micro societies are built upon individuals interacting, right? And individuals are the smallest unit ultimately. So when we talk about an anarchist society, what we're really just talking about is those interactions proliferate, those anarchist interactions between individuals proliferating to an extent to where the social functions of a society, which are like legal arbitration, security, things like that, are compatible with the anarchist philosophy, right? So you can still have anarchist interactions even if you're not in an anarchist society, right? So like when two people interact and they're not ruling over each other, between those two people, the interaction is an anarchist one, even if the larger society that they live in is not. So you can be an anarchist, and you can also be an anarchist even if you think the state will never go away. So it very much is this idea that to be an anarchist, you just have to believe that the people who are initiating violence against other people are illegitimate to do so, and they don't have a right to do so. And that when someone does have, is being violated by someone else aggressing against them, that person has a right to resist. And that's, if you apply that consistently, you're an anarchist, and it doesn't matter if you think the state will ever go away. And, you know, a good analogy for this is, we'll never have a world without murder. Right. You know what I mean? But that doesn't mean that, well, we should just side with the murderers or give up. You know what I mean? So like we keep on believing that murder is wrong, even if we know we'll never, ever get to a world without murder, or maybe even a society without murder. Right. So it's very much this like Sisyphean struggle where we'll always keep rolling that boulder up the hill because we believe it to be right. But it doesn't mean that if we fail, we've lost everything. Right. It's very much a step by step, day by day thing where it's just like, yeah, you can just be an anarchist.
All right. So last thing, I guess.
Sure. Absolutely.
I just thought about it when you were talking about that. And it kind of reminded me of you talking about or you quote tweeted Austin Peterson, and it was about minarchism.
Yes.
So you can be an anarchist and believe in all these things. Why is minarchism not the way, just so I can shit on Jared later?
Okay. So, so minarchism is, I'm going to like, say my quote tweet because I really like that.
That was perfect.
Minarchism is the belief that the state is evil, corrupt, and inefficient, and therefore they should be in control of the most important social functions imaginable. right? So it's like the anarchism essentially is this idea that, well, free, we need, you know, freedom is good, but the problem with anarchism is that we need a rule of law, which they would say only the state can have a rule of law, which I would obviously disagree with. We need a police force and we need a military to defend us, right? But when you look at the state, the state's control of those things are by far the worst things that they ever do. Like if you look at the legal system and all the people who are in prison right now for bullshit laws, it's an incredible tragedy. You look at all the people who've been murdered overseas because of the state's military. It's incredible in the worst way possible. And then with the police force, I mean, look at all the people who like get murdered by cops all day, every day, and nothing ever happens to them. So I find the minarchist position to be like completely anathema. If a minarchist came to me and they said, okay, look, here's my stipulations. I really like freedom, but the state has to monopolize shoes, TVs, and cars. I would rather have that than have a state that monopolized law, police, and military. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah, they're going to do less damage having those other things that they have a monopoly on versus that. So it's, yeah, that's my critique for anarchy.
Yeah, there you go. Fuck you, Jared. but fuck, dude, that was awesome. I loved everything about that.
Oh,
Word it incredibly well.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate you coming back on. We're going to have to do this pretty... We'll probably do this a couple of times just because Typo and I are going to get off this and be like, fuck, we should have asked him about
that. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for inviting me back, too. This is great. I love talking to you guys.
Fuck yeah, dude. And we'll have to do like a current event episode at some point because...
For sure.
When current events pop up, I'm like, I wonder what Ace would... think about this specific one, like how does anarchist philosophy fit into this? And usually you're quote tweeting about it anyways, so I'm like, all right, well, now I get to know a little bit more, but I always want to go into like an in-depth conversation with you, and I'm not very good with words. I'm better at speaking than I am typing, so
I'd rather talk
to you on a podcast than message you on a DM. So again, thank you for coming on. Go ahead.
My pleasure.
Any plugs you got.
Talk about
the podcast. Talk about your channel and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can, I co-host the Slurp Gang podcast, which is, it's nothing like this. It's much worse. My apologies. No, it's me and my friends, Con and Jay. It's not political whatsoever. We just like riff bullshit every week. And, it's just a way for us not to lose our minds, in this insane world. And, you can find me on Twitter at @ace_archist. And I'm always quote tweeting someone and getting into arguments I shouldn't. So if you enjoy that, go ahead and follow me or don't, you're free not to.
Dude, I'll be honest. There's a few that like, I tried to go all the way back to the beginning.
Oh no.
And like halfway through, I was like, I can't do this, dude. Like it was like 1 minute of me clicking like into the thread, and I'm like,
Jesus Christ, someone dude. Posted a meme of like what it's like seeing following Ace's quote tweets, and it's just a gif of like a mirror into a mirror into a mirror gone forever.
That's what it felt like, dude.
Yeah.
It's so hard to find the beginning sometimes. Yeah, dude. I'm like, fuck, and then I'm sitting there for 30 minutes trying to find the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, I do this. So I do that. So I should actually explain why I quote tweet. I do that because if I have a point, then I feel like someone's raising a good point against like anarchism. I want to do it for as most people as possible. And I don't want to just be hidden inside of a thread. So I do that so more people can see it in case they've never heard it explained away, or if they might have had the same question or something. So that's why I quote tweet. I know it can get annoying for people, though.
Yeah, I can't. I can't unroll the thread.
Right.
I was going to ask too. If someone was like just getting into anarchy, would you advise them on any sort of podcast, or would you advise them to any books to read? What do you think?
That's a great question. I actually have a reading list somewhere and it's bookmarked, and maybe I'll retweet it after this or when this episode goes out. Podcast wise, I got a lot from Tom Woods personally. So I would go back into Tom Woods, especially some of his earlier episodes, like 200-300 in around there. Go back and listen to like any of them that catch your eye or you think that might address a question you have. Definitely start there. That's my for podcasting. For books, this is always a good one. Anatomy of the State is never a bad answer to that question ever. You can start with Anatomy of the State. you can work into other, like, it all depends on like where you're coming from in anarchism. Like some people, as Luke said, come from like a more economic phase, and some people come from maybe like a more moral intuitionism type thing. So it all depends where you're coming from. But Anatomy of State's great. Most things by Rothbard are fantastic. So definitely he has, and Rothbard is actually great for this, because Rothbard talks about economics and moral philosophy. So if you just jump into him, you really won't go wrong there. Also, I think Lysander Spooner is a good one to jump into. Benjamin Tucker has some good articles who I'm really a fan of. Some of the old anarchists like Voltairine de Cleyre, some of the older anarchists, those are really great. If you really want to get into like some of the nerdy, like hard questions of like anarchist philosophy, Roderick Long is probably one of the best libertarian theorists alive right now. So he really goes in depth as to like much more than I did or have. So I would definitely check out him if you're into that. Hans Hermann Hoppe is another good one to check out. It depends on, you know, what you're getting into or where you're coming from, but I think that's a pretty good starting list. Yeah.
What was that one book, Rule of Law, you said?
Oh, so I'm sorry. Yeah, this is how my mind works. I completely forget. Yeah, sorry. John Hasnes, he wrote two great essays. John Hasnes, yeah. So he wrote, it's an essay, it's The Myth of the Rule of Law. And then he wrote, oh my God, I'm blanking. Why Not Anarchy, I think it's called, I'm going to forget now. I'll remember it after this, but he wrote another one. You mind if I look it up real quick?
No, actually? Go ahead.
Okay.
If it's written in Cran, I probably won't, like, then I'll be able to read it, but.
Right.
If it's not written in Cran.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called I can't believe I forgot. It's called The Obviousness of Anarchy. And it's one of the best anarchist essays ever written. So yeah, John Hasnes, two great essays, The Myth of the Rule of Law and The Obviousness of Anarchism. Read those. And it's and also one more book, Edward Stringham's Anarchy and the Law, is also like very practical, real world applications of anarchism, and how like a lot of the legal systems we have right now actually could easily work in an anarchist scenario. So that's also a great one. I recommend that one.
Okay, I'll have to check those out, because that's usually one of my biggest hangups is like, all right, how does law and order go into these systems? Yeah. And you know, it's a question for a lot of people ask. They're just kind of, I think that's what they're most scared of, is society devolving into chaos.
And it would be remiss of me if I didn't plug, if you're at all anti-war, which you should be, you should pick up Scott Horn's two books, Fool's Errand and Enough Already.
Yeah, we're shills of that too.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I'll end on right there. But yeah, definitely check those books out.
Perfect. Well, again, thanks, Ace, for coming on.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, we're definitely going to have you on again, and we'll do some current events or something else, and maybe you can get Typo and I to be on Slurp Gang, and we can
absolutely
joke
yeah.
around and shit on there.
Because yeah, absolutely.
Because that's what most of our... The only two shows that are like... we have three shows that are coherent, and we're not babbling idiots that are making dick jokes, and that's when you come on.
Yeah.
So the two times that you've been on, and then the third one was when we had Ryan Whitaker's brother on. So we couldn't be babbling idiots for that episode. But every other episode, we're babbling idiots. So
oh yeah, absolutely. We'll set that up. Yeah, yeah, we'll definitely do that. Yeah,
you guys
for
want
sure.
us on Slurp Gang? We'll be the babbling idiots at every.
For day. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks so much for having me on. This was great. I've said this before, but I wanted to do an Anarchy 101 podcast just so I have it here. Now, see whenever someone asks me a question, I can just plug this episode. It's like, here, listen, and then
there you go. Yeah. And if you ever think of like Anarchy 102, we'll be the guys to do it. So
absolutely, yeah. Thanks. No, thanks so much, guys. This was great. I love talking to you guys.
Yeah, no problem, man. Thanks again. We really appreciate it, and you have a good night.
Oh yeah, you too. Thanks. Thank you.
Boom.